We're talking about late bloomers here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Late bloomers may have these things in common: fumbling starts, college gaps, career gaps, bad luck, underwhelming first impressions, just milquetoast. Ranking people by a handful of metrics is the way we put people in their places, right? It's how you rank students. It's sometimes how you advance employees at companies. Did you fulfill your potential later in life? Or perhaps you've always marched to your own tune. Do we put too much emphasis on overachievement? And what does that mean for our society? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Rich Karlgaard is publisher of Forbes magazine. He's author of Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. Rich, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, happy to be with you, Kate.
Our team had a healthy debate around your book yesterday, and it really centered around privilege, that it's a privilege to be a late bloomer, to take your time to find this meaningful destiny in life. And for instance, it's not affordable for working class families to allow kids to have a gap year. That's a luxury. When you see that education is often the only way to get ahead, to break the cycle of poverty, what do you make of that notion of some people who push for early achievement, to work so hard because they're trying to get a chance in the world?
Oh, I celebrate anybody who works hard to get ahead in the world. I deeply appreciate people who are more economically challenged. All I'm saying in late bloomers is, what if you're not good on that path? For example, in schools today, there's an outsized emphasis on how well you do in standardized tests, how well you do in your grades. But let's stop there. Maybe your grades aren't good enough if you didn't do them in advanced placement courses. Well, that's fine if you excel in those areas. But if you don't excel in those areas, the unfortunate byproduct is that you have many kids who are beating their heads against a wall, trying to excel in an area that they weren't really born to excel in. Their native gifts aren't there. Imagine you could be the best carpenter that your city ever produced, but your public school doesn't have any kind of a skilled trades track. And all you know is that you can't pay attention in school. You really don't understand the formula behind these standardized tests in a way some kid who's been tutored to excel in those might understand them. And you come out of school, and all the feedback in school has been that you're second rate, you're a kid who can't pay attention, you're really kind of hopeless. Where all that happened in that process was that kid had his or her weaknesses revealed rather than his or her strengths, as opposed to the kid who does really well in standardized tests and grades had their strengths revealed. So I think that human talents cover such a broad spectrum, and our deep motivations cover such a broad spectrum, and our passions and all of those. So I don't think this topic of late blooming is a luxury of the privileged at all. What it is, this book is all about is right now we have way too many people on the sidelines in the United States economy, even in a growing economy, people who feel they aren't thriving. They aren't thriving in their 20s, they aren't thriving in their middle years, and they aren't thriving in their later years. And I think that's an outrage in a country as affluent as ours and an economy that the GDP statistics say that we're growing.
So where did this obsession with early achievement come from? How did we get on this cycle?
Yeah, my theory here, Kate, is that if you look at the last 15, 20 years in the U.S. economy, the two most reliable creators of really profitable careers and a chance to get rich have come in two areas. They've come in software-based technology. Since I'm from Silicon Valley and have a kind of Silicon Valley bias here, I call it Silicon Valley technology, but it exists everywhere around the country where you have software companies that are growing really fast, and they either go public or they sell to some larger company, and in high-end financial services, or what you might shorthand as Wall Street. Those two industries have pay outsized salaries and bonuses, or people have a chance to do very well by cashing in their equity at some point of the company they've built. Now, those two industries reward a certain kind of skill set, particularly in the early screening process when they're looking for employees. I'll just tell you what's going on in Silicon Valley, where I've lived my adult life. By the way, I was born and raised in North Dakota.
North Dakota. You represent Bismarck, huh?
Yeah, Bismarck, North Dakota. So Baja, Wisconsin, if you like.
We digress. Right. Okay.
Yeah, don't Minnesota standing between us. But I've lived my adult life in Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley is a kind of closed club, and it wasn't always that way. It used to be that people like Bob Noyce could come out of Grinnell, Iowa, and move to California and excel, starting a company as he did with Fairchild Semiconductor and later Intel. But today, it's kind of a closed club of people who've gone to a select number of schools like Stanford, Harvard, MIT, Caltech. And it's almost like a secret handshake, because if you want to raise money from venture capitalists who have similar backgrounds, 40% of all venture capitalists in Silicon Valley come from two schools, Stanford or Harvard. You know, generally Stanford Engineering and Harvard Business School. And, you know, they perceive that to succeed in Silicon Valley, and the same thing is true of Wall Street or with high-end financial services, that if you have an 800 math SAT test and if you went to an elite school, then, you know, you've checked all the right boxes.
You can write your ticket.
You can write your ticket. And it's been moving that direction steadily over the last 20 years. Back in the day, you know, in the 1970s, let's say, Silicon Valley was the home of tinkerers in garages. Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, you know, were tinkerers in garages. Both, when they started Apple, neither had a college degree. Steve Jobs dropped out of Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and Woz would eventually go on and get his degree at the University of California at Berkeley. But they weren't sitting there in front of computer terminals. They invented the personal computer industry. They were tinkerers. They worked with their hands. They soldered, you know, chips onto boards and all of that kind of stuff. And it was a different kind of an entrepreneurial ethic than it is today, that when you're raising just tons of money from people who've gone, you know, 40% of people have gone to two schools and have this very narrow view of what constitutes success or the formula that will create success. Hmm. So anyway, that's my theory, is that because the two most lucrative parts of the economy are the two industries that screen for elite school degrees and high SAT scores, that has trickled down into the economy and created this sort of obsession that if you want to succeed in this technology and finance driven future, you have to demonstrate your early excellence there.
The book is called Late Bloomers, and author Rich Karlgaard stays with us. Are we expecting too much of our kids and young adults? Do you think we're pushing them too hard early on? Were you a late bloomer? Did you find your passion later in life, and what is it? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the fixation on early blooming and this narrowed view of what success looks like. It's an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and the book is called Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. Rich Karlgaard poses the question, how can the curious and creative, the searchers and explorers, jump off the dominant culture's conveyor belt and begin shaping our own fates? He warns the road is crowded with early bloomers, and by the time late bloomers arrive, the paths to opportunity are closed off. Are you a late bloomer? Did you feel like you lagged behind your peers? Perhaps you made a career change, learned a new skill, or came up with a great new idea. Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. And Rich Karlgaard stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Don joining us from Sussex. Hi, Don.
Hi. Hello. I'm definitely a late bloomer. I'm 50 years old, still trying to figure out what I want to do, but I also raised five daughters. And thank you for saying narrowing path and conveyor belts, because I feel like we lose these kids and what their true purpose in life is, starting with middle school. I used to say after eighth grade, let the kids take 2 years off. And luckily, I live in a community where they can mentor many businesses or arts or crafts or... And I say, because we're living longer and working later in life, we have time for these kids to take a gap after middle school and really find out what their purposes are before they fly into that conveyor belt of high school and society pressures. I watched my own daughters. I tried to keep them off the conveyor belt and let them find their own ways of life. And, of course, they got sucked into the tube of sports and took them longer in college to figure out what they wanted to do, extra years. And it's just, even as a mom, I got sucked into it a little bit too, but you're just, you feel like you're fighting against the grain when they don't fit that normal track of
fit that mold. What people need. Yeah.
Yeah. And I say, let them take 2 years off after middle school. It was funny because I used to say middle school, eighth grade. And then they talked to somebody the other day and they said they were giving college tours to seventh and eighth graders last week. And I'm like,
oh,
are
goodness.
You kidding me?
Don, thank you so much for the call. Rich, what do you make of a gap year in those middle school years?
Well, Don just summarized the whole reason I wrote the book, and thank you for calling. I'm all for gap years. You know, gap years have gotten a bad reputation they don't deserve. It's the idea that kids from affluent families can take 2 years off, you know, usually between high school and college or during college to go on some kind of extended vacation. Sometimes that's how it's portrayed in the press, and that isn't it at all. You know, a gap year where a child, I hadn't thought of a gap year between middle school and high school or in those mid-teen years, as Don suggested. It's a great idea. But gap year should be work. Gap year should be working on farms. Gap year should be doing a church mission. Gap years can be challenging. They should be physically challenging. They should be an opportunity for the child or young adult to see the world from a different perspective, to develop a broader gauged view, to begin to exercise different capabilities and discover things that they might be passionate about or talented for. And, you know, I really want to rescue this notion of a gap year. And you know, Don understands it perfectly, that this isn't about gap years aren't the luxury of affluent parents sending their kids on a 2-year extended vacation. They're a chance to really kind of go back to some earlier principles that we once had about education that involved hard work.
Well, Don, Don brought up raising her daughters. Does our society evaluate early achieving men and women differently?
Yeah, I think it does. And, schools have become, as I said, this conveyor belt, you know, with extraordinary pressure both on the kids and on the families. Just think about parents. You know, every parent today that aspires for their kid to go to college now has put themselves into a position, you know, whether they're ever doing enough. If people are raising the bar of competition by spending thousands of dollars on tutors and SAT prep coaches, or in the case of sports, look at how we've professionalized youth sports. It used to be that a kid could just show up for football practice and decide whether they wanted to play football or gymnastics or track and field or you name the sport. And now today, that kid who thinks they might have an interest in a sport arrives, and the places are already filled with kids who have had been in some organized program starting at a much earlier age. And so we've backloaded all of this, you know, the pressures that we're putting on kids, professionalizing everything. Now, I think the Midwest, God bless the Midwest, because I think the Midwest is less subject to this than are the two coasts. For example, in New York, there are two or three preschools in Manhattan that charge $45,000 to $50,000 a year for 3 and 4 year olds. And in their literature, they promise a multi-building campus, immersion into, you know, different languages, et cetera, et cetera. We're talking about 3 and 4 year olds.
Yeah.
And the not so subtle message here to affluent parents in Manhattan is that you better do this now, because 15 years from now, when your kid doesn't get into an Ivy League school, the fault is going to be yours. Well, you know, I suppose we need Tom Wolfe around to write novels about that kind of, you know, that sort of bonfire of the vanity way of thinking about it. The problem is it's trickled down.
Well, I want to stop you there for a moment. There is that achievement aspect of, you know, getting the kids into this, you know, exceptional educational schooling and the six art rooms and immersion in a second language and all. But there's also the social networks there, that this is their, you know, ticket to rubbing shoulders with other families who are like-minded, who are trying to, you know, get to that opportunity of that path on that conveyor belt. So it's, you're also glomming on to these other people who are thinking that same way.
Yeah, you are. And that gives these kind of schools incredible pricing power, as, you know, colleges have incredible pricing power. We should step back and look at it, how, you know, why is the cost of a college education, when it's, you know, all in room and board and everything else, why has it gone grown three times faster than the rate of inflation since 1970? It's because the colleges have unlimited pricing power, and they have an unlimited pricing power because of this misguided belief that if everyone doesn't go to college and doesn't go to the most expensive and elite college they can get into, you know, that somehow their chances in life are compromised. And so what I did in Late Bloomers is I wrote about that. I wrote about how the SAT test grew out of the American version of the IQ test, which was rooted in eugenics. So right there, you have a very bad seed that still, you know, that still exists within the SAT test. And I also dived into neuroscience and psychology to say, what do these two fields say about how the brain develops and how our emotions develop and how our talents and skills develop over the course of our lifetime? And it's just that's the positive part of the story, because we have these unfolding gifts over the course of our lifetime, and yet we're not even seeing these you know the full extent of our potential lifetimes. You know, even though American longevity has hit a plateau the last couple of years, when you factor out the 20% or so of the population that is kind of thrown in the towel, they're so, you know, they feel so alienated from society and the economy, that longevity is still growing in the United States. And so people born today, I was just at a AARP conference in Washington yesterday, and they've got a lot of science behind this. People born today in birth years of 2019 have about a 40% probability of living past 100. So why are we not, you know, why are we not taking the longer view of how the human being develops over the course of their lifetime? And if you fail to meet the first gate, you know, on time, does that doom you for a second-rate life? You know, I just makes me angry that I think our school system and societal pressure today seems to believe that.
Well, and you point out in your book that the brain isn't really developing creatively and thinking more broadly in well into your 40s and 50s.
Well, this is really fascinating, Kate. First of all, the prefrontal cortex of the brain isn't fully developed until the mid to late 20s. And that's sort of the, you know, that really is the beginning of our adult functioning. There's a reason why car rental companies charge a higher fee for 18 to 25 year olds. They're more accident prone. They're more impulsive. And they can be tremendously gifted, you know, in their field at age 18 or earlier. They may be tremendously gifted musicians, mathematicians, entrepreneurs, etc. But they simply are, you know, a couple bricks shy of a full load when it comes to their adult functioning capability. And then in our 30s, 40s, and 50s, this is really interesting. There was a 2015 study, and we'll come back to it.
Yeah, we got to pause right there. What happens later in life? The book is called Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. Author Rich Karlgaard is publisher of Forbes magazine. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We're going to look at specific strengths of late bloomers, what happens in the brain later in life. That's coming up after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We are spending the hour exploring the upside of finding your way later in life and why that can lead to more achievement, perhaps more happiness. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and Rich Karlgaard is publisher of Forbes magazine. The new book is Late Bloomers, and he writes about what he sees as a late bloomer crisis. He says human progress will stop if a majority of late bloomers feel untapped and unacknowledged, and the market is huge and unaddressed. Are you in this group? Do you see the case for patience in a culture that's so focused on early achievement and high scores? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Chris joining us from Richland Center. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
What's on your mind about this?
Well, I guess it's not just this program. The last couple, I feel like schools are getting knocked in all your programs, and I guess what I'd like to ask is, has he been in schools to see what's really going on? I am all for exploring careers early. I'm a special ed teacher, and many of my students struggle. And it's not about finding a job where they're going to make millions of dollars. It's about finding a job they love. And for some of the kids that have been through trauma and all this other issues, I've taken fifth graders into colleges just to show them the path that they could take and show them what is out there. I've also taken them and shown them four-year colleges, two-year colleges, one-year programs. There's so much out there that I think by having kids explore different possibilities, you find out what they're really interested in, and sometimes it's not one thing. So at these young ages, we can take them to places and show them what the career is really like. Just because it looks one way doesn't mean that's what it's like.
Chris, thanks so much for the call. And Rich, you know, allowing the kids to see different experiences early on makes a difference.
Yes. Well, I think we need a revolution of more Chris's in the public school system who have that broad-gauged view, who see that there are kids of all kinds of different gifts and challenges. And not everybody, you know, is going to thrive in a program where it's skewed toward test scores and high grades and advanced placement courses and trying to get into the most expensive college that you can. And we need more of that. You know, one of the things that I discovered during this book is that only one out of 20 public high schools offers a skilled trades track, or what we used to call shop class, back in the day. And yet you read any number of articles that talk about the shortage. Employers can't fill these skilled trades jobs. So economically, the compensation for skilled trades have gone way up for welding, for HVAC work, for all of those kinds of jobs. They're intersecting with technology in a way they didn't before. And there are a lot of kids that exposed to that would find that they have a path to thrive. And by the way, going into skilled trades doesn't mean you're cutting off the path for college later if you so choose. It means that consider a welder, a kid who becomes a welder at age 18, makes pretty good salary. Then at age 26, decides they want to become a civil engineer. What employer would not want somebody who was both a skilled welder and somebody who had a civil engineering degree, for example? Or many of those people who go into skilled trades will discover their entrepreneurial gene and decide to build a company around the trade that they practice. I know this because every week after Christmas, my wife and I go from Northern California to Southern California and rent a condo in Indian Wells, and we rent it from a plumber who lives in Newport Beach and has places all around California. In other words, he's a very successful plumber who built a very successful plumbing firm. And these are the kinds of different paths I think that we need to show kids and encourage kids for. I'm convinced after having done this book that the Midwest is much more sensible about this than are the coastal areas, like New York City, San Francisco, Bay Area, et cetera.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Nick joining us from Antioch. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I find this interesting. I went to school and got a bachelor's degree in English literature, intending to go to law school afterwards. And I clerked at a law firm just as an office clerk right out of college and found I couldn't handle the environment being inside all day and, you know, being under fluorescent lights, essentially. So I went back to school for geology, and now I'm a geologist.
Oh, that's fascinating. Do you like your work?
Yeah, I love it. I like being outside, and, you know, I was lucky enough that the partners at the firm were supportive of me, you know, changing my mind, and one of them even co-signed my loans when I went back to school. So I knew I was in a sort of a privileged position that I could change my mind and afford to go back and do something that I loved. And I know not everyone can do that. It's very difficult, you know, with tuition fees in the United States to do something like that.
Yeah. And you were pretty far down that path of that law vision. Was it scary to really redirect and say, you know what, I need to change course?
Yeah, it was. I sort of looked at it as, you know, it's just as important to know when to forego an advantage as to take an opportunity, because they said, you know, go to law school and we'll hire you when you get out. And it was a good, successful firm and would have been much more money. But I just didn't picture myself being happy. And, you know, the first time we went, we did field camp towards the end of my program, and I saw mountains the first time, and I knew that's what I really loved. But how would you know that if all you've ever seen is classrooms, you know, in college?
So what do you hear, Rich, in Nick's story?
Well, I think it's fantastic. I had my dreams of being a lawyer disabused as an undergraduate when I took a class in constitutional law, and I simply couldn't read case studies. I simply couldn't get my head around a sentence that was written, you know, for a contract or anything like that. It just made no sense to me at all. It's like a foreign language. And so I dropped out of that. Look, I think what the caller did was just excellent. The power of quitting is a chapter that I had in my book, Late Bloomers, that I think we do kids a disservice when we feed them this popular culture idea that quitters never win, winners never quit. I know that Vince Lombardi, who's reached sainthood in Wisconsin, you know, said that, and so I probably shouldn't go against Vince on that. But look here, you know, quitting, you know, if you're going to be a miserable lawyer, and you know that in your bones right away, that's not quitting, that's a strategic retreat. Richard Branson, the entrepreneur, has quit several businesses, Virgin Cola, Virgin Brides. They simply didn't work for them. Entrepreneurs are doing this all the time. You know, in advocating quitting, I'm not advocating that people, as a first response to adversity, develop the habit of quitting. That's not it at all. But they have to look, you know, at whether their time, their treasure, their talent, their sense of purpose are properly allocated. You know, and if you're trying to push a rock uphill because society expects you or your family expects you to be a lawyer, and you know in your bones that you're not going to be one, then save yourself some trouble and some money. There's one other person who quit law school. that became a big success. That's Daniel J. Brown, who dropped out of law school after 3 days. He was so miserable. He became an English teacher in junior college. He then became a technical writer at Microsoft. And in his 50s, he'd saved enough money. He started writing novels and history books, and they didn't succeed, but they were critically acclaimed. And then his third book, The Boys in the Boat, about the 1936 eight-man rowing team that won the gold medal in Germany, became a bestseller. It was on the bestseller list for 2 years. He published that book at age 62.
Hmm. That was a long trail there. Let's go to Lucy now in Racine. Lucy, hi.
Hi.
So what is your story on being a late bloomer?
Oh, I guess I stepped out of his book, but I haven't read the book yet. I am a reading teacher in Racine, Wisconsin, and I became a teacher. My goal was my bachelor's degree by age 50 and my master's by 55. So I'd had quite a bit of traveling, and I had a son late. I was 41, and I ended up divorcing my husband, and we needed to find something I would be able to have traditional hours so I could have life with my son without the support of my ex-husband. So I became a teacher, and here I am, molested, scorned, Racine, and I'm a reading specialist for 6th, 7th, and 8th grade students.
So in those early years before becoming a teacher, did you anticipate that your life would take longer to unfold?
Partially because I did quite a bit of traveling. I did work, but I did quite a bit of traveling. And it was in the back of my mind to become a teacher once I worked at a biomedical research lab and heard women speaking, and I thought, I'm going to go back to school. So I was raised in the 50s and 60s, and college wasn't always necessary. It might be desirable, but it wasn't always necessary, and I wasn't able to afford it, nor were my parents. So I knew I had to pay for it myself.
And Rich, it sounds like Lucy knew that she had the long view here and that college wasn't, you know, something that her family could afford then.
Yeah, I really applaud her for the long view. I was starting to talk about this study that came out in 2015, led by Laura Germine of Harvard and Josh Hartshorn at MIT, who are doing postdoc work at Massachusetts General Hospital. And they asked the question, at what age do we cognitively peak? And they were surprised by the complexity of the answer, because the answer was, it depends on which cognitive ability you're talking about. So there are certain things where we peak early. Rapid cognitive processing speed, working memory, the things that make you a really good software programmer. In our 30s, 40s, and 50s, a whole set of attributes, deeper pattern recognition, compassion, empathy kick in. And then in our 60s and 70s, the sort of the ancient idea of wisdom, there's a neurological reason why that gets better. And so teachers, you know, teaching is a career where you can be good, you know, you don't have to be good early. You can be, you know, in fact,
and
you know,
we have to
years is really an attribute.
Pause right there with Rich Karlgaard, and we'll continue the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. We're learning about why our society pushes students to achieve early, why companies covet young talent, and why it's important to identify and promote late bloomers. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've been talking about how there's no timetable for success. Rich Karlgaard is author of Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement, and he stays with us through the hour. Let's go back to the phones now with Carrie joining us from Madison. Hi, Carrie.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well.
Great. I love your guest, and thank you so much, and I cannot wait to buy his book. I'm a high school counselor, and I just believe so much about everything that I've heard about on your show this morning. You know, I talked with the person before, and I agree with him on all of these points. And, you know, I would say from school counseling perspective. And I think I would echo what Wisconsin school counselors do. We really try to look at the individuals, you know, and what makes sense for them. So, you know, we have a push in Wisconsin to investigate academic and career planning with our students. All of our students are looking for an academic and career plan in grades 6 through 12, and it's all about exploration and what makes sense for them, and just knowing that as they experience life, those directions change. And so, you know, I also said to your screener, one of the things that we're dealing with at my high school is a huge rise in academic integrity issues. And so one of the plans we're going to have for next year is to really tackle teen pressure head on, whether that comes from family, society, peers, all of the above, and really to help them cope with that in coordination with exploring who they are and, you know, and what makes sense for them as they move through life. So,
what do you mean by academic integrity exactly?
And cheating, you know.
Okay.
The cheating, you know, and you know, these are really good kids. And when you talk about why they do this, a lot of times, you know, they just feel this intense pressure to achieve.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, you know, I think they are exposed to so much, and we just try to want to put things in perspective. And you know, we're constantly talking to them about how they, you know, again, that frontal lobe develops, you know, they have a lot of time for that to develop. And so we really want to, you know, help to coach them. And, you know, again, I think a lot of the pressures I see do come from society and parents about what has typically been expected. And, you know, we are all about, you know, there is no more typical. You know, you need to go out and you need to experience life. And, all, you know, there's so many wonderful opportunities. I agree with your guest about the gap year. I think for some kids that makes complete sense, you know.
Rich, okay. I want Rich to respond here. There is this intense pressure from families, and it's, you know, Carrie seeing it in the area of cheating.
Oh, boy. Well, thank you, Carrie, for that, for everything that you said, and please spread the word. Yes, well, look at the high end, the most extreme and perverse example of everything Carrie is talking about came out about 2 months ago when we started learning about all these college bribery scandals. Very affluent people bribing college admissions directors or coaches in what you might call country club sports, like sailing, to get their kids into schools that these kids couldn't otherwise get into. Cheating, boy, it's rampant and it's hard to catch. We have some acquaintances where I live in California. They were the dad was telling me that his kid had surprised everybody by the essay he produced for his college application process. And I said, well, tell me about it. Well, he said, I never knew my son was so interested in Renaissance science. And of course, red flags are exploding in my brain. And it was clear that the kid had plagiarized this piece and that the father just turned a blind eye to it. I mean, if he thought for a minute that was happening, he denied, you know, and he was able to tell me with this with enthusiasm. This kid had never shown 1 ounce of interest in Renaissance science.
Let's bring in Cece to the conversation. Cece in Door County. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just want to talk about late blooming a little bit. I became an entrepreneur at 48. And this is after being a preschool teacher, an insurance agent, and many other different things. But I realized at a certain point that I had a tremendous amount of experience in life. And it made me great at customer service. And I also wanted to be more physically active rather than be in an office environment. So I started a vacation rental cleaning company. And I've never been happier.
Cece, thank you so much. A vacation rental cleaning company. And it sounds like she was able to take some decades to figure out what she liked and what she was good at.
Yes, and I took note of the fact she did this at 48. And there's this myth out there that you have to be young to be an entrepreneur, where the Kauffman Institute, which studies entrepreneurship in America, said the average age of starting a company is 47. a notion that I want to get across is the idea of being pulled versus being pushed. You know, society and parents and the school system pushes kids and pushes all of us to try to meet, you know, their expectations. And, you know, can we thrive over the course of our lifetime if we're constantly being pushed? Being pulled is a sense that your talents, your sense of your passions and your sense of purpose are all in alignment and you're being pulled. And I've seen people become entrepreneurs that were pulled, felt this pull. And one of the things that every entrepreneur learns right away is, you know, you have to be good in sales or you're not going to be good as an entrepreneur. That terrifies people. That terrifies introverted people. It would terrify me. But when you're being pulled, it's amazing the gifts that you get along the way. The introvert who never thought they could sell anything to anybody, you know, being pulled in their own business that they started, suddenly becomes able to do that. The shy person begins to develop the heart of a lion. It's amazing. And that's what, when you're blooming, when you're in alignment with your talents, your passions, and your purpose, and magical things happen there. I wish that every child, young adult, middle-aged adult, later-age adult could have that feeling of being pulled because they feel like they're in alignment.
You bring up the concept of repotting and this notion that you should try to align, and you can later in life, with your talents and your missions. How does repotting work, and how do you make it successful when it's really hard to get rehired or try to start a career when you're later in life, in your 50s perhaps?
Well, repotting is this idea that there's an environment, professional associations, colleagues, friends, you're either being well served by that or you're not. And if you're not, if you're in the wrong company, if you're hanging out with the wrong people, if you feel like you live in the wrong zip code, you have to consider that maybe you need to change one of those things. I think about a couple of Wisconsin entrepreneurs, Dale and Alan Clapmeyer, who were suburban Chicago kids, but it was in rural Wisconsin that they started their company, Cirrus Aircraft, which is now the leading company in the world making small airplanes. It's now in Duluth, Minnesota, but the Clapmeyers will forever be known as Wisconsin kids, when in fact they were Illinois kids. They were suburban Chicago kids, but they knew they could start their aircraft company not in Illinois. They felt that for a variety of reasons, that Wisconsin was a friendlier environment for them to start an airplane company.
Diane Hendricks, you bring up a daughter of dairy farmers who also found her way as well. You bring up a lot of these stories on Late Bloomers, and I want to end here, and we only have a few seconds left, with what are the greatest strengths of Late Bloomers? What is their greatest asset?
Curiosity. You know, our curiosity peaks when we're kids. But what this conveyor belt, I keep going back to the conveyor belt, what the conveyor belt and society's expectations do is they ask you to trade your natural God-given curiosity for this determined focus, where it is, in fact, your curiosity that is going to be your greatest ally throughout your life. It is the source of innovation. It is the source of discovery. It's the source of you finding that alignment of your passions, talents, and purpose. Curiosity is a great one. And I'll give you one more. We're running out of time. Equanimity, the ability to stay calm under pressure. Think about Captain Sullenberger landing the plane in the Hudson, or Tammy Jo Schultz landing the disabled Southwest Airlines in Philadelphia. Sullenberger was 58.
And we have to end it there, Rich. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Rich Carlgaard is publisher of Forbes magazine, author of Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent on the Ideas Network.